Hey folks, do you recall the hype around promises of democracy during the so-called Velvet Revolution of 2018? Yeah, those were the heady days, with pledges of true democratic Armenia, where citizens' rights would be respected, and so forth and so on. But fast forward nearly 6 years, and let's be honest, Armenia's democracy and human rights regressions, serious regressions, are difficult to ignore, even for foreign-funded NGOs with a geopolitical bias. Now here's the thing. For a long time, talking about Armenia's democratic backsliding was considered taboo. That's why we're rolling out this new series on Grung called Spotlight on Silence. We're not going to shy away from tough topics that others sweep under the rug for whatever reason. With expert guests, we're going to give you the real scoop on how democracy and human rights can simply be ignored when it suits the powers that be. And why are we the ones doing this? Because frankly, it seems like we're the only ones who care about talking about this, especially in the English language. You see, a lot of the usual civil society folks and organizations have been oddly quiet about what's happening in Armenia. Maybe they're on very long vacation, I'm not sure. But that's a shame, in any case. But why, really? Well, like I said, many of the funders for this type of content also care about geopolitics, probably more than they do care about human rights. Why? Because they are foreign governments. And at the same time, many of the established so-called human rights watchdogs in Armenia are uncomfortably cozy with the Armenian government. So buckle up for content that you won't find on your usual foreign-funded channels, or even Armenian-funded channels. Will we cover everything? Probably not. But we're going to do our best to bring you the most pressing stories that we feel are being underrepresented. Today, we're putting the spotlight on political prisoners. It's a pretty serious topic, and we'll only be covering the tip of the iceberg because it's a really large topic, so we will have to split it into multiple parts. And thus, here's our first installment of Spotlight on Silence. But first, please like and share this content on your social media, and consider donating to us to increase the reach of this show. The links are in the description. Hope you enjoy the show, folks, and please keep the feedback coming.
Welcome to the Spotlight on Silence episode. Today, we're talking about the rising problems of political prisoners in Armenia's degrading democracy and human rights environment with Rafael Ishkhanyan. Hello, Rafael. Thank you for coming on the show. So it's an honor to have you with us. Thank you for joining us. Since this is your first time on our podcast, can you give us a little bit about your background in your professional activities for our listeners?
Thank you for having me. I'm a lawyer. I studied here in French University, then American University of Armenia. And basically the last 10 plus years I've been more or less involved in many projects, monitoring projects, programs with human rights, but mostly I specialize in freedom of peaceful assembly and association, and also the freedom of expression. And I'm also a member of the audio panel of experts on freedom of assembly and association. And recently with some colleagues, we started a new organization, a watchdog. We'll be focusing on political rights, and it's called Armenian Center for Political Rights. So that's about me.
Rafael, 6 years have passed since the so-called Velvet Revolution. Our impression is that most countries, especially Western countries, that have human rights on their foreign agenda, pay lip service to Armenia's democracy. Essentially, it is a taboo for them to criticize democracy or democratic regressions in Armenia. So the organization you are part of, the Helsinki Committee of Armenia, recently issued a report called The Human Rights of Armenia for 2023. We have a link in the show notes for those who are interested. And the report goes into several different areas. You talk about the judicial system, you talk about freedom of peaceful assembly, torture and violence, political persecution, electoral rights. And I'd like to ask you a little more questions about this, but what's interesting is that in doing research for the show, I went through the U.S. State Department human rights reports for Armenia after 2018. And in all of them, like, you know, when you look in the section for political persecution, it says, you know, there's no credible reports of political prisoners in Armenia. There's no credit. Every year, the same thing. Can you tell us about your report in general? And how does your report differ from reports from some of these Western sources?
Well, I think first of all, when you are monitoring human rights, and if we're talking about the opinion coming from United States, of course I suppose specialists involved who are drafting these reports, but still you have to look into a completely different legal system and a completely different cultural context. And I think it's inherently difficult to try to evaluate that very precisely. So, well, I'm saying this as a disclaimer. It may sound like that I'm not picking on whoever is evaluating what's happening here, because I think that we are the ones, I mean, those living in Armenia, we are the ones who have to talk about this, because we are not committed to human rights because it's written somewhere in some international document, but because it's for us. I mean, it's our rights of this country. So, basically the report we are in at Helsinki Committee, which I'm contributing to, is published annually, and we have like several topics which from long ago been on the spotlight of the committee. And the last years, maybe I go just through the main topics, because I think each of them is it may be a subject of a separate podcast, but yes, the judicial system. So judicial system is, many lawyers would say is the immune system of a state. Because when you have something going wrong, well, in the end, someone should have the remedy, and this is basically what's called in the legal jargon, it's the remedy. When you go to court, you are going to have a remedy there. So I can just start by the citing the words of the president of the Supreme Judicial Council, the body that is charged with appointing and dismissing judges, Karen Andreasian. He said, I think the end of the last year or maybe beginning of this year, that from 2018 till now, out of 300 plus some judges, 200 are reappointed during these 6 years. So basically during the time of the rule of a party which had absolute majority and a qualified majority in the parliament, and they were we were appointing the main offices of general prosecutor, the candidates to the Supreme Judicial Council everywhere. They were appointing them without the need for support from any other faction. So basically this, I think this is somehow a confession. It sounds like a confession that whatever they are calling a vetting is basically that more than 67% of judges currently in Armenia in office are appointed during one party rule. That's why you can call it
essentially one party rule. When 2018 happened, there was a lot of discussion about judicial vetting and having a procedure to formally requalify all the judges and take out all the bad ones. But essentially, it seems like they found a shortcut, which is in some cases pressure the judges, in some cases I'm not sure, wait until they retire, and then just reappoint people or appoint people who are agreeable to them. Is that the case?
Well, it's absolutely, it is. I mean, from the beginning of the rule of the new political elite, let's say, of the civil contract party and Nicole Pashinyan, from the very beginning, the issue with the judiciary was being presented in different spotlight. I mean, the issues were there, and there are, of course, in any post-communist country. You have a very hard time finding a country with strict and very well operating judicial system. But whenever the changes are being brought, you have to look really inside to see if it's genuinely for the rule of law, because most of the times it would be just a political expediency. So basically the civil contract party and prime minister himself from 2018. He started this rhetoric against the judges, supposedly, allegedly, the collaborators of the corrupt former regime. That's the rhetoric that put on the table. And in 2019, the famous case when by this personal call, people encircled and basically occupied the court buildings. And by the way, it's funny because the observers at that moment said that there were no more than 1,000 or 100 people there. So there was a real minority, political minority involved in this, which is, I think, it's a good thing that there was not too many people to me.
Yeah, I remember that day very well, actually. It was, I believe, May 2019. And yes. He issued a call. He said, and it was right after the case of Robert Khocharyan. Speaking of no political prisoners in Armenia, if you look at the report for U.S. State Department in 2019, you will see no mention of Robert Khocharyan, political prisoners, Robert Khocharyan in the political prisoner section. But he got very upset, pissed off at that ruling, and he said that they're going to blockade all the courts. That's a very interesting development, right?
Yep. And basically it was there were the party members and the members of parliament involved in it. So this was the start. I mean, for many people, this should have been the red light that from this moment on you see the apparent pressure from the executive branch on the judiciary. So from this moment, I mean, keeping this episode in mind, this incident in mind. Whatever we're talking about, the judicial reforms coming after this, which involved pandemic, war, another war, and another war. I mean, it's obvious that it wouldn't have been objective, because it was not addressed properly. The pressure from the executive branch. By this incident, they say that the prime minister and his team, they checked the reactions. So what would be the reaction of the watchdogs of the international community, and seeing that they have the green light, so they went on. The next incident we have with the former head of the Supreme Judicial Council, with the Constitutional Court.
Was it Harair Thomasyan?
Yes, basically it was against personally him, as it was perceived maybe the one was influencing the court. But in the end, he's still in the Constitutional Court. But the other members, the composition was changed so that the majority now are loyal to the current government. Mm-hmm. And Harair Thomasyan is still there. He was just deprived of his presidency, but he's still a judge. So then again, you can see that there was just a pretext that alleged violations that he may have did, they were not the reason why all this affair against Constitutional Court was taking place. It had just one purpose, to change the composition and have the majority there, which currently they already have. Then right. We had the incident with the president of the Judicial Council, Supreme Judicial Council, Vartazarian, if you remember, when he tried to speak against the insults of the prime minister against the judges, when he was saying, so those are moaning dogs under the walls, and something similar I can properly translate to English. But basically he said that at one moment that now we have to show to judges, we show, are we professionals or we are dogs moaning under the walls?
Yeah, I think howling, it's very interesting how Pashinyan uses language. Especially when you talk about hate, inciting hate speech. But it was right after, I believe, November 9-10 agreement, where Vartazarian said, the upcoming period is going to be very important, and I call on all the judges to prove that you are not a howling dog. And essentially it was meant as a call, in my opinion, at least I perceived it as a call to be impartial and, pursue the interests of the state and of their profession rather than persecuting, opponents of the regime. At least that's how I interpret it.
Yes. There's this debate on how much judges, the members of the judiciary, how much freedom of expression they have. But the international standards, the common sense says that, of course, they should have some degree, especially when it concerns to the operation of judiciary itself. Because no one else can see what's the problem with the judiciary besides the judges. So basically, Vartazarian was then replaced with a quite infamous person, the Gagik Cihangirian, And I mean, people would remember well, he was before, decades before, he was the military prosecutor. And in 90s, he was also, I think, I don't remember the exact office, but in the electoral committee. And he was also accused with rigging the 1996 elections. So basically,
yes.
Person with a real bad reputation when it comes to things that like rule of law or legality, equality, whatever. So he was he replaced Vartazarian, and the thing that what happened later, this the leak, well, it was not a leak, that Vartazarian's recording when he published,
yes,
where we saw that there were two members of the Judicial Council, one of being the Jahangirian, were just openly telling Vartazarian, so you have to step down because otherwise they're going to initiate some other criminal cases against you.
Yeah, avoid. Let's avoid all the headache. Why do you need all this headache? Let's just step down. Let us, you know, do our thing.
Yeah, but basically a high-level political bargain in the Supreme Judicial Council. So of course he couldn't. Well, there was this. Was this? This. I mean, the scandal was the magnitude that even Jahangirian didn't survive this. He was removed, but of course, because citing his health concerns or how
spending
he's done
time with
this,
family, right?
Yeah, the situations. And then we saw the last chapter. So now we came to the what's happening now. Darren Andreasian, also famous for being the human rights defender during Serge Sargsyan's period, and just to say that that at that moment when he published a famous report on judiciary was praised a lot when he was a humorous defender, but then he became party member, a member of the Civil Contract Party. Then he became, I mean, at that moment he was also the Minister of Justice. And just from that, he jumped to the Supreme Judicial Council. Of course, he quitted the party formally, but I mean, we all understand
that's a formality.
It's a formality. After that, the cases against judges, they plummeted. I mean, the 30 or plus cases just in 2023, and most of them were, I think a huge number of them were initiated on disciplinary proceedings. Even for a judge who just questioned the fact that Supreme Judicial Council is having decisions in consensus, mm-hmm. just saying that this fact itself is quite worrisome. For these words, he was stripped from his right. I mean, he was fired from the judiciary.
Yeah.
So then we have this situation. I mean, just keeping in mind, first thing, judicial system, the court system, that's the immune system of the state. So if some disease and you don't have the judicial system which operates based on law, on the rule of law.
So, Rafael, does it make sense to have a Supreme Judicial Council when you want a democracy that has separate branches of government, judicial from legislative? Under the current situation, it seems like the judicial system is completely subservient to the legislative system. My question is, does it make sense to have an SJC, or do we have problems in the way we have constituted the council?
I think the way it's written in the text, how it should operate. Well, of course, there may be some reforms, but basically, it can operate if everything is, all the procedures are kept and all the let's say no political pressure is exercised. Because you know that there's this thing, and it not only concerns to the judges; it concerns to any office that has power to or obligation to protect human rights, like mm-hmm. the ombudsperson, the human rights defender. These type of offices are the most independent when they are not operating during the rule of those who appointed them.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look the case of the former human rights defender, Armand Tatoyan.
Right.
Because he was praised as being a very good
active
human rights defender, at least starting from 2018, because there were cases that he'd been criticized. He was criticized before that, some instances. And this gives you an idea. I don't want to, you know, go too deep into his example, because Well, I respect him a lot. He was also my professor in the university. But this illustrates that whenever you are operating based on your constitutional independence and no one is interfering, you are more independent, of course, when those who appointed you are no longer there. So again, coming back to the situation when we have 60 or 70% judges removed and replaced during the rule of one party. So what are you going to expect from them? What I believe is that if there's a change of power, those 60% judges, maybe they have to be left alone. Maybe they will operate then better because now they will feel the independence. You can't find a perfect person. The perfect person wouldn't go to this office.
Essentially, what you're saying is that they have stacked the system and they rely heavily. In Armenia, personal relationships mean a lot, and especially who appointed you, who gave you your job, and who can take it away from you. And this government is relying heavily on those relationships, on those unwritten rules. At the same time, they're also stacked the system. So we saw that they passed legislation to stack the constitutional court in their favor. Rafael, as far as I understand, they also introduced legislation to stack the Supreme Judicial Council in their favor. Specifically, they reduced the threshold under which the Supreme Judicial Council can make decisions that disqualify judges from, like, I think 70% or from two-thirds to 50%, which means that the judges that they appointed recently will have a higher weight in the decisions of the Supreme Judicial Council. Is that correct?
I did not follow too much on this recent developments, but again, I mean, the procedural rules, the laws, you can change them back and forth all the time. But there's this the actual issue in the heart of the issue is that the cases of the judges criticizing some issues in the judiciary being dismissed for allegedly saying some political statements that they're not supposed to. Though this is wrong. The thing is that it's wrong, and it is just wrong interpretation of law. You have to look somewhere if you want to find a source, but there are plenty of them. The Armenia is a part of the European Convention of Human Rights, and there's this European Court. There are plenty of rulings. There are plenty of other, like the Greco standards and everything, that of course the judge has rights to criticize to some degree the operation or whatever it concerns the judicial branch of the power, because they are the ones who are in a better position to understand the issues. So basically, when they are dismissing these judges, they are violating the rules that are now in force in Armenia. My point is that, yeah, you can change the legal background, the legal rules back and forth, but the issue is the practice rather than what's written there.
Mm-hmm.
That also, but the practice is the most is the heart of the issue. And when I said about the perceived independence, actually I did not check that, but I think that in university where we were discussing the Supreme Court, well, opinion, or I don't know, maybe it's a statistic that the judges, when they are leaving the office, they are awaiting while the Democrats, either Republicans, would be in power at that moment. So the newly appointed judge would be more or less from that, you know, from that wing. So somehow to keep the balance of the court. So the balance is everything to me. And we could have balanced Supreme Judicial Council if there was no this political pressure and this wrong interpretations of the law.
Okay. So what else from your report would you like to highlight? Because we are 20 minutes in and I think it's important. Okay. We talked about the judiciary. What else do you think is important to highlight?
Well, again, everything starts from here and now we can go on. So last year, and it is covered in the report, I mean, one of the most, the focus things, the things in focus were the cases of three lawyers, attorneys, being subjected to physical violence in police departments. And of course, this was unprecedented. It's not because the lawyers were not ever been, you know, persecuted or, you know, subjected to some pressure, but it never happened in the police department when they are completely in the, you know, let's say in the control of the police staff. So the three such cases just in half a year, and there's no criminal verdict against any perpetrator to this moment.
Is there even an investigation or an allegation of criminal?
Yeah, there was. Initially, I read about the disciplinary proceedings. I think there's also there may be a criminal case initiated, but this case is just go nowhere.
Right.
And this also brings to the next point, the peaceful assemblies. So yeah, I mean, everyone knows Armenia has the vibrant history of assemblies of protests, and many praise the law, the 2011 law, which is far better, far more liberal than in many European countries. But again, the impunity of police violence is still the number one issue. So and from the last years, this cases started to take even worse. You know, they became even worse from in the context that before that we had instances of police violence based on testimony, based on some other facts, some indirect evidence. But now you have police officers in front of the cameras without feeling, you know, guilty, let's put it this way, for that, beating in groups even protesters and not receiving criminal penalty for that. So I'm not going into the disciplinary proceedings because this is just an image of something being done. It won't affect the perception of impunity. If the police officer conducts violence, beats a protester, and there were many cases of that, and is not punished criminally, so it's going to happen again and again, all over again.
In terms of peaceful assembly, is it just applying violence? Because I also think that the sensitivity of the law enforcement to any criticism is also very important, because in terms of the number of people that are taken into police stations during protests, like without any reason, so the police can essentially detain someone without any charge for 2-3 hours. I believe it's 3 hours. It happened to me. Like, I actually attended, I have been detained by Armenian police 2 times. One of the times was because I was on September 21, 2022. I was in the Yerablur with those parents who were, you know, brutally treated, and I was just like recording, and they took me away. So the ease by which people are being detained. We remember during the protests of 2021, 2022. I mean, they recorded some of the highest number of detentions. So I believe even those soft means by which people are swept away from the streets and their rights of assembly are disrupted, it may be as important, if not even more important, than beating them, or, you know, once they detain them, even if they detain them for, say, rightfully. And then also one time I was just Pashinyan. I raised my head and I saw Pashinyan walking by, and I called him a traitor, and I was also detained for 3 hours because of that.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, if you call the head of state a traitor, there are some countries where you still will have problems. One of them is Turkey, which we brought into comparison with the recent with the recent cases to compare that, because it's a highly criticized law, this Article 299 of Turkish Criminal Code, that insults against the president are, they I think there's up to 5 years of imprisonment if it's done in public. So yeah, basically that's there's also another implication to the apprehensions, the arrests that police practices, is that when you have the large protest and you have, let's say, 10 or 20 people being brought to the police departments, arrested, then the protest goes on. They still express their opinions, their views. And then even if it's taking too long, maybe the others would come back from these 3 hours. There have been the case many times. But when you have And especially in these situations when this political polarization is at its highest, you have new groups trying to form and trying to get into the agenda. And whether in numbers they are less than the traditional actors in the in on the ground, there are also other implications that this is basically hindering their right to assemble at all. The example is the last year's example is this Zang Initiative, BEL in English would be. So those were young people mostly. They were well. I'm not supporting this, of course, this rhetoric, this former's news and whatever, but because there is the perception in some parts of the public. So those are people not tied to the former's or new elites. Let's put it this way. Because many people, when I follow the political opinions here, many people are saying, so we want to see new faces, yes, on the political arena. So those people were these new faces. And what they were doing, they are simply putting a tent, just one single tent, as a symbolic item, which from their commentaries is that it's representing the statehood, and they are protecting it. So it was a symbolic flash mob or assembly protest, however you call it. So nearly 50 times, police detained them, confiscated the tent, and so kept them several hours in the police department, but basically that stopped the assembly itself. If they
Yes.
had plans to go there to, hold the assembly for some, 3 hours, 4 hours or something to have the impact on the passerbys, on the public general, that they were deprived of this opportunity for the simple reason that for being arrested and because of the numbers, the assembly stopped, or basically the police bans the assembly by simply arresting the most or all the
Essentially,
participants.
yes.
Yes.
Zhang, I definitely, they essentially tried to nip it in the bud and not allow the movement to grow. But even when there were mass protests, I mean, there were some days when there were 500, more than 500 people who were detained. And the reason that I think that this is unlawful is because when you look at the number of people who are then actually charged, is much less. So they detain them. And the only purpose of that detention seems to be to keep them off the streets. And then 3 hours later, they can come back, but then the intensity of the protest has been
Yeah, they've modified
disrupted.
the dynamics of the protest. They've taken the energy away.
Yeah, all the essentially
Absolutely.
all the important participants would all the most vocal participants are taken away.
Well, but there are standards, and yeah, the mass protests, they are most of the time they are not proportional. They can be proportional because if it's not a riot, which was not, I mean, the last years there were no riotings in the sense that whatever the criminal code says, because you have to have the overwhelming violence there to call it a riot. Because if there was even several incidents, if there are incidents, some people which are acting violently, well, there's the obligation of the police to, of course, to isolate them. And the rationale behind is not because, okay, so there's the wrongdoer, so we have to arrest. No, the thing is that they are, in the first place, disrupting the peaceful assembly, the right to assemble peacefully of those who are in the area. So that's basically the obligation of the police to facilitate the assembly. They have to isolate the violent people, let's say. But mass arrests, they are always disproportionate. But
Yeah.
we have what we have.
Hovig, let's just take a moment here. We'd like to remind our listeners to go to our donate page, podcasts.grung.org/donate, or just go to podcasts.grung.org and there's a donate link there. And consider buying us a coffee, or better yet, become a sustaining member of Grung through our Patreon link and give us monthly.
There aren't that many shows like us who digest Armenian news weekly and bring you interesting discussions relevant to it in English language and in a regular manner. We have always operated as a labor of love, and we're not only nonprofit, but we're also non-budget, unfortunately. So we rely on listeners like you to help us. Just two to three friends who have committed our life's time and effort to understand the world around Armenians and Armenia and sharing that understanding with you.
So we will continue to do our work as we always have, but your support will help us expand our reach to more people who are interested in Armenian affairs around the world.
So please visit our donate page. Again, podcasts.groom.org/donate and consider supporting us. Thank you in advance. We appreciate your listening to us, and we take that trust and your support very seriously.
Thank you. Okay, well, for today, let's talk about three cases of political persecution and political imprisonment that are related to each other. What they have in common is Articles, I think, 329 and 330 of the Modified Criminal Code of Armenia, which requalify the old Article 226 of the code. The criminal code was modified by the Civil Contract Parliament in 2021 during COVID lockdown, like you said a little earlier. The existing law on incitement of hate speech for things such as race, etc., was amended to include additional categories, including worldview, whatever that means really, political or other views. We've put a link in our show notes to both the new and the old codes. But specifically, Rafael, can you tell us more about this law, what the purpose of this law is, and how it is being implemented?
Yeah, sure. So, this hate speech law, so we call them hate speech laws because, you know, if you look into this hate crime context, hate speech laws are not very common, not in every countries, because and there's no uniformity how they should be. If you read all this approach, this when they are covering the hate crime, they're saying, so we don't go into hate speech too much because we see there's the lack of uniform approach in the OSC, of the OSC countries. But basically, the hate speech should be a type of hate crime if it's in the criminal code, it's in a penal code. And the only thing similar to that we had was this incitement of racial hatred, which was an old one, and it came from long before. I think it was also in this model criminal code of this CIS penal code, but whatever. So I remember that in 2000, I think in 19, the talk started that the parliament were planning to amend the code. And actually, at the moment, I participated in one of the hearings. They want to amend it with a new hate speech law, which would be this modern one, because the old one had very specific characteristics there. So it's racial, religious, and ethnic, I think, there are just three of them, if I'm not mistaken. So the new one supposedly include other ones which were more like stigmatized or more targeted, like sexual orientation, gender identity, and many others. So, but what they did, instead of tailoring it to the needs or to the situation, basically, initially they just took the article from the Constitution banning the discrimination, which says discrimination is prohibited based on everything, basically. Yes,
the color, race, religion, gender, sex, etc. Yeah,
and they just took this text and just put it there that. The cost of violence based on everything which was written in Constitution is banned now criminally. So there's the biggest issue with the text to me is that when the Constitution puts the general ban on discrimination, of course it should leave the list open, because with the you can change Constitution every now and then, and you have to have some regulations which are there for the upcoming, let's say, generations. Yes, ideally you should not change the Constitution at all.
Almost, yeah, right.
Well, yeah, or amend it like the US does, but then you are putting this formulation in a criminal code, which can be amended all the time by Parliament, by simple votings, and then you're putting this open-ended list. So there's this issue with the legal certainty. Incitement of violence or incitement of hatred, which is current formulation, there are two of those, against people based on any characteristics. So this is quite difficult. Actually, yeah, if you look it into very, very, let's say, blatantly, you can say, well, being a fascist is also a personal trait. So we can say if it also covers that. No, of course it doesn't, but it brings this legal uncertainty to that. So that's the first issue. The second one is that there are, yeah, you said there's worldview, political view. So basically, worldview,
What is
it
that?
was, as far as I know, it came to it came from like early days from the older codes, from maybe even before, maybe from it has some Soviet origins. I don't know. I mean post-Soviet origins of this model criminal code. When you have the religious discrimination, and then you have these agnostics, atheist people, which claim they're not religious, of course, and then you have to put the somehow their protection together, equal to the religious views. And what's being an atheist? It's a worldview. So
Okay.
they basically that's why they call it. And then there's this political opinions, and this is the cornerstone of our issues at this moment. So political opinions, when you see it, I mean, without context, you would think that, well, I think it concerns to a person who is, I don't know, has socialist views, or the other one is more, I don't know, libertarian, or the other one is communist, because there were prosecutions for that in the history. Yeah, like in Indonesia, the people were persecuted and prosecuted because being communist, because having communistic, let's say, political opinions.
But it
So
seems to me that if we have put the government in charge of deciding what kind of speech is allowed, regardless of whether it's religion or non-religion or political, apolitical, then we have no free speech.
And that's what happens when you have no supervision over what government does, when of course, and that's what happens. So basically, the statistics say that 95% of these hate speech law cases are the ones where the target was the prime minister or his team, basically his supporters, his party members. And I just looked before that. I mean, I may be mistaken, but I'm mostly sure there was no, well, at least no serious case of charges, criminal charges against someone who incited hatred based on sexual orientation, let's say, or in some cases some ethnic characteristics, because there were cases we observed here happening. So mostly it's the political opinions, which is construed identical to the party membership or the civil contract party.
Yes.
And you said these cases of Narek Marlyan, Sanver Vartanian, and Armen Grigoryan. But Narek Marlyan's case is even more curious in this regard, because what they formulated in the charges, that that it was based not on the political opinion of the party, but of some part of the party members. It drives me crazy, because I had really hard time understanding this text when they say, so Narek Marlyan incited hatred of party members of the civil contract party, some members towards the other members. What's the
Interesting.
characteristic here? I don't understand it. So hate speech laws and hate crime laws, you have to have this characteristic. So it's not simple insult. It should be based on something, some trait, which people share with each other. And when you asked about how's the approach overall in the world, well, in the countries that say in a better human rights record, when you look there, those characteristics are limited to those which are, let's say, inherent to a person, like a skin color, which you can't change, the ethnicity you can't change. Well, the religious, yeah, maybe it's debatable, but still the religion also is very inherent to a person. And that's destined to protect these characteristics. But being a member of some party, I mean, just look who are the MPs at this moment and how many parties they changed
Right.
just in a decade. This
Right.
cannot be interpreted as a personal trait. Even though we can go further, the prime minister himself and many of his party members said many times that civil contract party is not adhering to any isms, that they're not adhering to any specific
Ideology.
ideology. Yes.
Right.
So what is their political opinion? It's just a party membership. Well, if they say, you know, we are prosecuting you because You incited violence based on party membership. Well, I would say, yeah, I mean that legally, it's legalistically, it's correct. Then we should go there and see if it's proportional or not. Because it's one thing when you are criticizing or even insulting someone based on their religious views, it's bad. But when it's done to the government officials, the criticism level is much higher. You can be more insulting towards the government officials rather than ordinary citizens. So that's the other part of the issue here.
So how much prison sentence can someone get for insulting a segment of the civil contract members against other segments of the civil contract party?
If I'm not mistaken, it was up to 2 years, but that's the ordinary one, because then you can have this aggravating circumstances and it can go up to I think 3 or 4 years. I'm not sure, but at least three. It's at least three. So yeah, the Narek Malyan's case,
So it's a
he was
serious, like, felony level crime,
it's quite
essentially.
serious. It's quite
Yes.
serious. Of course, I mean, but the thing is that you look into the practice, the issue is with the practice. So several levels of issues there. First one is that capacity. So, I mean, we adopted these laws, and many countries struggle with them because, you know, like in countries like USA, the hate speech is still in a debate whether it's protected or not in the First Amendment. So we're bringing it here when we don't have. That's my opinion. We don't have prosecutors and investigators with the capacity to actually evaluate those, and then you have the issue of practice, and this is the biggest one. So there were several cases of Pashinyan supporters. One of very famous one, his name was Rustam Avakian. So quite a scandalous person, and he was openly insulting all Karabakh Armenians. With very mature content, very insulting content, without any discrimination to, you know, those who are supporting the political elite or not, just literally everyone, and calling for them to be treated some in a bad way physically. So there was a criminal case against him too, actually, and they're not initiated by the motion of the law enforcement. They were initiated because some people, that one of them, a journalist, I think it was Hohikian, who made a statement to the police. So there's the case. You have to initiate some proceedings against them, and then in the end did. But they didn't use the pretrial detention, and they didn't detain him. In the end, he would get away with a fine. And in the second case, it was a conditional sentence. But when you have those criticizing or insulting the civil contract party, you have detention as a must. And then in Narek Malyan's case, we see also you have imprisonment as a punishment.
Right. Very selective application of the law.
Okay, so I mean, let's go into specific cases. Last week, Samvel Vartanian, he was arrested for insulting Member of Parliament Hakop Aslanian of the Civil Contract Party of Armenia. And we have seen the videos. There was a little bit of pushing, but it was mostly insults. Initially, he was charged with hooliganism. So this is interesting because the charge of hooliganism, especially the severity that he was charged with, does not include a jail or pretrial detention. You cannot detain someone on that charge. But we found out that during the days that he was held, his charges were amended to include political enmity, inciting political enmity. And with that, you talk about the 2 to 4 year prison sentence, and the severity is such that then the judge can issue pretrial detention or some other alternative form of detention. Vartanian was alleged, but what's interesting that, so what happened was after that evening, Vartanian was being transported from the location where they were initially jailing him to the final, detention center. And shortly after they left the police station, the two police officers stopped the car. They found, according to Vartanian's testimony and testimony of his lawyers, they found a non-popular spot, like a spot that is not well visible and so forth. They stopped the car, and the police officers left Vartanian handcuffed in the car in order to go and, to pee or whatever, to relieve themselves, to take care. What's interesting, there's a lot of, we can go deeply into why, they would needed to pee so quickly after leaving the police station. Do they have some kind of a health issue which precludes them from being a member of the police on duty? Or why both of them at the same time decided to leave the car and said, just hang on here, we'll be right back. But what happened was, as soon as they left, a group of men wearing masks and wearing sort of non-identifiable clothing, they took Vartanian, they beat him, they threatened him with sodomy, they dragged him on the ground and essentially roughed him up and then put him back in the car. And then once the police officers came back in the car, they said, oh, what's wrong with you? Why are you so, like, distraught? I don't know, like, why are you complaining about? And it was all reeking of these mafia movie style, tortures and punishments that people get. What's interesting is that the police officers who allowed this to happen are still, I believe, not under any kind of administrative sort of leave. So they're still executing their functions. The identity of the man is unknown, and the Ministry of Internal Affairs, of course, launched an investigation, but there is criticism that it was days later. The reaction should have been much, 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 much faster. And of course, also the Human Rights Defender's Office, they sent assistants. The Human Rights Defender's Office sent her assistants, and the assistants were essentially silent for hours or actually days until they issued a call for the prosecutor's office to investigate the case. Meanwhile, we remember that this human rights defender in person attended and talked to the Azerbaijani saboteurs who actually killed a human, an Armenian in Armenia. But apparently this was not a high profile case for the human rights defender to visit and make sure that he's being treated well. Did I miss anything from this description, Rafael? And what can you highlight? What can you call out that is specific or special about this case? I don't remember any history of this in the last 10, 15 years where someone is beaten while in police custody and everyone is walking scot-free, it seems.
That's the incident that happened. I think the important thing is that, well, with the torture, we always had this bad record of addressing torture, and until just recently, I think there was also on the old time criticism of human rights defenders that even if the police officers were charged criminally, the qualification of the charges were never put torture, except for very few cases which happened before the war, if I'm not mistaken, maybe one after. Have to check that, but again, there were not these high profile incidents and those under this very huge public spotlight. But what I think is interesting with this case is that it had, and also which to me is the reason why he was put only into house arrest, which itself is this type of an arrest. I mean, it's not something you say, oh, it's okay, so great, he's not in prison, he's at home. But still, there's a lot of, he's still in isolation for that. But why, with all the logic, we would think we were expecting him to be put in the detention as the others. But what was the reason why it was not the case, to me, is that there was a huge consolidation of opinions, and maybe really an unprecedented one, that the NGOs, human rights defenders, political parties, I mean, starting from far right to the far left, everyone condemned this, of course, with different lexic, with different perpetrators in mind, let's say, if it's police or if it's the civil contract party, because if you remember, just before his detention, there were several calls from party MPs urging the police to find him, to arrest him for hooliganism. They were also qualifying, legally trying to qualify it. And also this infamous article from the Hayk Akan Jamanak, which belongs to the prime minister's family. Some person I didn't know about him before that, calling that if he's not treated as he should be by the law enforcement, we would resort to their means, to their, I don't know who he's implying, probably again the former regime, whatever, and will beat them in the backyards, simply
Or
by
and
them.
kill them in the bathrooms.
Yes. So yeah, and kill them in the bathrooms. Yeah, sure. And because all the reaction after this that came from the general public, and that's what I mean, I think was the main reason that all the demographics, all the, let's say, layers of the active society condemned this with different words, but still they condemned it. And I think this was the reason why he was not put in the pretrial detention as everyone else, but still he's in the house arrest. But they still can, I don't know, they still can appeal it. So I won't be surprised if he's detained in the end and he still doesn't address the issue we're talking before. So of course the police is very attentive to what's happening if the target is the representative of the ruling party. And yeah, they charged him with hooliganism. Then they amended another one, incitement of hatred, I think. And there's this multitude of issues you can think about that. So there were insults, and of course there are procedures in the civil procedures for that. You can go to the court and demand apology. All right. So it was something else. It was something criminal. It was hooliganism. So for being something a hooliganism, the person should be should have this what is called the disrespect towards society. That's how it's called. But well, when you're looking the material of the incident, you see a lot of hatred there, which is directed towards identifiable person because of their party and because as a very, of course, insulting criticism of the policy that the party is pursuing. So was there this motivation to show disrespect towards people? No, actually, to me, it's not. I put it this way. And when you're talking about insulting the ruling elite or whatever, so there's again this caveat. They can be insulted much more. And I'm not saying only them, everyone who is at this moment is in power, whoever is the government, they should take more insults. Let's say they have this kind of insult-proof vest on them, which should we, they should wear while they are having their tenure at their office, and they should be expected to be insulted in some cases. But I think that's a good thing that there was this huge consolidation and the statements by the public. So at least in something, the Armenians are, agreeing with each other.
But I mean, let's just also state that for all intents and purposes, Samvel Vartanian's freedom is still limited. He is still a
Yes.
prisoner, but he's a
Yes.
prisoner in his own home. So, I think that that's why we have decided to highlight his case as a political prisoner. Now let's move to Narek Malyan's case, and I'm gonna also do a quick introduction. Narek Malyan was initially, he has two cases, two criminal cases, both are around the same law. I'm not sure if it's exactly the same. In one case, during the 2021 protest events, he directed a performance of the execution of Nicolae Ceaușescu. If you don't know who that is, he's a Romanian dictator who eventually was executed by during a revolutionary times there. And for that offense, Narek Malyan was charged with justifying violence, essentially because if you hold a performance of an execution of a political leader, it's called justifying violence. But there are so many cases where like effigies of people in the West are being burned when similar cases in the West are happening. So I'm not sure how, it's curious that that's considered justifying violence. But in reality, he was exonerated of that charge. He was exonerated by lower courts in 2023. But what's important to highlight is that because the system is carrying out political orders for the ruling regime, they are so stubborn that they actually were not satisfied with that charge and they want to please their boss. So they appealed that decision in 2023. And just recently, I believe a month ago, his verdict in that case was the initial verdict, which not guilty verdict, was upheld. So on the Ceaușescu case, you know, he's exonerated. But during the events of September 19, 2020, when Artsakh was being essentially ethnically cleansed, he made some Facebook posts. And during those Facebook posts, I think he said something like, you know, we're going to go and have coffee with civil contract leaders and their moms or something like that. And for that, he was charged with inciting hatred and intolerance. And he's in jail since that time for those, for that perceived offense, for that alleged offense. Essentially, he was arrested on September 20. And just recently, I believe last week, the lower courts issued a guilty verdict for him. So this went beyond pretrial detention. And now we'll need to go to appeals court. And I believe the lawyers are, determined to go all the way. So this may even go into the European Court of Human Rights. What are the merits of this case, Rafael? Did I miss anything important? The same guy essentially is being charged on the same crime. During one of those cases, he was exonerated. Now he's he was found guilty on this other case, but it's being appealed.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's what actually we mentioned in our report, that the time period was so short after his acquittal and the new charge. And the thing is that one can say for 100% that he was still kept under the spotlight. Any wrong move committed by him would be immediately noticed. So we have to go a bit into the merits of this case because I would say if it was not of importance of a country, if I wasn't for importance of freedom of speech in a country where I live, I would really be happy to study this kind of this type of case as just for fun. Let's put it in this way. So he's charged for inciting hatred based on some protected characteristic, how they put it. And the characteristic what they put it is the political opinions. In the factual, when we go to the facts are the violence, the incitement of hatred was that, so whatever he was telling during this live feed, and the political opinions are, I always get very confused when I try to formulate whatever they wrote there, is that so he was inciting hatred against members of the civil contract party, against the other members supporting the prime minister. So it's not even the party membership which is the characteristic.
The whole group.
It's a segment of a group which itself, because as we talked earlier, the inclusion of the of the party membership as a protected characteristic and putting them on the same level of protection as the race, ethnicity, color, religious views, it's absurd because it can be changed a lot. Many people change their political camps all the time, every year maybe, I don't know. And then they are now dividing them. And so it turns out that being a member of a party and having a different opinion in the party compared to those who support the leader, this is some characteristic which should be protected by hate speech laws. So what even is this opinion? I mean, can we formulate what is this opinion? Because if they would say like in the different cases that the reason was that those are the adherents of the civil contract party, so and they follow their political agenda or political ideology, which is very hard to state since We talk that this party is denying that they have any specific ideology. So what is the opinion of a member of those who is against the other member supporting the minister, the leader? So I don't know how this even this case holds itself. Basically and of course there are many procedural violations which the lawyers talked about, but I mean, to me, that this merit is also important.
Yeah, speaking of these procedural violations, or even going before that, how does the police find out that someone made a call on? I believe they cite that, you know, they're doing monitoring, or so they have some kind of a monitoring function, right? So my question would be, are they monitoring civil contract members? Because you cited the case where the Prime Minister's newspaper issued, like, you know, published an interview where the person, the interviewee, said that they should kill and beat people, yet no one is arresting that person. So how is the police doing monitoring? Is that monitoring being done, you know, randomly, or is it only targeting the opponents of the regime?
Well, I mean, absolutely, it's done. Well, I know that police does monitoring of assemblies, and it's an ordinary thing. The police have to do some monitoring, not very deep, because it should not amount to profiling of personal data or anything like that. But at that date in September, the protests were spontaneous, and they did not issue prior notice. So if you look from this perspective, the police have to monitor somehow because they have the obligation to facilitate the assembly, so have to appoint a representative to the protests to safeguard the rights of the protesters, etc. But the Malian's case again, he was if you know, he was also he worked in the police apparatus before, years ago, and he's always claiming that in his statements that he has connections inside the police, so he was not someone unknown to the police. And of course, all these circumstances together will bring to the situation that he would be one of those, you know, top in the top watch list for those who are monitoring for whatever ends. But he would be under their attention, and he was, of course.
But watching that, watching a select group of people, what I'm trying to understand is that legal? Is that appropriate to do?
Well, to me, it can be appropriate if we are talking in a different context. Let's say if there's a group which had a history of, you know, armed crimes,
right,
seizing buildings, let's
or if
say,
they're a problem in national security or something like that.
Yes, but then you have a person who is a very famous protester. He was just acquitted by a court for his political protest, and it was not the first time he was doing political protest. He was doing it long before. If you remember that this case that he put the statue of George Soros in front of the Open Society Foundation office, so I mean, whatever, it doesn't matter what the person's views are. This was a peaceful protest, and so he's quite known. Let's say he's an activist. So put it this way, and he has a record of nonviolent activism. And it doesn't count whoever, what kind of opinions have against him or for him. He had a record of quite satirical, let's say, political activism, and which already had a court verdict that it was okay, the Ceausescu's the shooting staging. So yeah, I mean, I'm 100% sure that he was under specific spotlight for monitoring. But then, if you remember, that was the day when Azerbaijan attacked Artsakh in multiple, fronts, and this large scale war started. And with all this situation going on in Armenia, you probably it comes to the point that you had at least one police officer constantly monitoring Narek Malian in all this situation when there is the imminent risk of war and so many things happening, and they are monitoring this activist with a record of provocative but rather peaceful protests. And at the same moment, if we are considering that, because in his case, in the merits, if we follow this logic, incitement of hatred towards a supporter of a politician, because it goes to this, to a supporter of one single politician, to the ruler of the civil contract party. So if we assume that this is a way to do is if it's legal, then I don't know. I mean, the Armenian law enforcement should probably next 1,000 years be concerned with this kind of criminal cases, because this means that everyone who says the some insults against the supporters of any politician, let's say any former president, any former MP, any current MP, anyone, this should constitute a hate speech. No, it should not. And that's the point.
Yes.
Even though if they are the targets are at this moment, those who run the country, those who are in government, those who have high public offices.
This topic about monitoring people is funny, if not sad, because we also remember the case of Aragats Ahoyan, who is, we'll cover him in a future episode, but in this case, the police claimed to open a criminal case against him months after the fact. So they said, as part of our monitoring activities, we determined that Aragats Ahoyan was violating some kind of a criminal code. So monitoring, I guess, that there is, I would really love to see more focus from the international observers and human rights activists and NGOs on how police are exactly finding out about these crime cases. Is it because someone in the Prime Minister's office is making calls, or are they, fairly trying to monitor the entire stage, for violations?
Or do
Okay,
they
so,
have standing marching orders?
or yeah, standing marching orders, make sure, anyone who criticizes the Prime Minister is a target. The last case is Armen Grigoryan. Armen Grigoryan was in pretrial detention since May 2022 on charges of, again, of inciting hatred under the Article 226 of the Criminal Code. So by the time of July 15, 2022, during the court hearing, unfortunately, he collapsed and died. Many in the opposition blamed the government, because if he was unjustly subjected to those conditions of the courtroom, unjustly targeting him, that could have contributed to his health case. So unfortunately, this didn't stop the Armenian government and the law enforcement from pursuing his case in court, and they eventually, I believe, found him guilty posthumously. These types of persecutions are having real effect on people, and unfortunately, in this case, the death of people. Many, I think, would rightly accuse the government of guilt in this case, at least, indirectly. What can you tell us about the specifics of this case, of Armen Grigoryan's case? I believe what he did, his offense, was that he called a certain segment of Armenians, I believe, Turks, or he said, the electorate in Gyumri are Turks or something like that. I don't want to repeat any kind of slur, but how is that defined? What are the specifics, and how can that be considered a hate crime?
Okay, I think here we should go into again into comparisons, because when you're talking about political persecution, political prisoners, it's one of the cases when person is considered such is when he's imprisoned, he or her is imprisoned in a discriminatory manner compared to the others. And that's when I mentioned the case of this of Pashinyan supporter who was voicing this insults towards Karabakh Armenians, all of them without any specifying the ruling elite or whatever, just absolutely against all of them. And that when the cases against him were brought by not proper motion of law enforcement, but the other citizens, He was not put in the pretrial detention, and even later, he was not so sentenced to anything related to imprisonment. It was suspended sentence, and that we have this thing that when the human rights defenders say that pretrial detention is in the countries like Armenia, we're not the only ones, is used as a punishment itself. So you can look into the statistics. It's funny because when the Department of of the judiciary published a report on last year, they said, well, the percentage of pretrial detentions dropped for 5% compared to the last year. Yes, but the absolute number actually went up to 60% nearly. So you have this huge number of pretrial detention being approved by the courts on indiscriminatory manner, arbitrary manner. So that's the first thing. I mean, yeah, he died while he was in detention, and this also should be kept in mind. So going into the let's say the other facts. So yeah, he used insulting language, and I think there's something which also differentiates from the first case, when I say the one insulting all Karabakh Armenians, is that first he was saying he's meaning those who were supporting the civil contract party, Nikol Pashinyan personally. There is, so you see the difference. There
Yes.
is, of course, insults are bad everywhere. That's not denying of that. But when you have the insults just for insults, which do not contribute to any political debate, like the case when this person was insulting Karabakh Armenians, calling them different nasty words. And then you have that different situation when the target or the, let's say, the source, the reason of the insults are some adherents of political configuration. So there's the it's aimed on supporters of the person with the most power in the country, the prime minister. It's not that it's acquitting for everything. But it's of course it's in a lower level of gravity because it's the other one, the other example, it does not contribute to political debate in any ways. It's just simple hatred for hatred. So that's the
Yes.
next part of the issue.
Okay, well, we are out of time, and today we covered a little of the bit of the basics of the sort of what we are seeing happening to Armenia's human rights over the last 6 years under the so-called Velvet Revolution. And more specifically, we try to shine light on three political prisoners whom the West simply does not acknowledge. They don't exist in their books. And we will continue to bring you episodes like this where we talk about different cases and different instances of political persecution. Thank you, Rafael, for joining us today. I really appreciate it. And
Thank
I
you for
hope
having me.
that you can come back soon.
Yes, and thank you. Thank you very much, and hope to see you soon again here.
Thank you, Rafael. Okay, that's our show today. The episode was recorded on April 20, 2024. We've been talking with Rafael Ishkhanyan, who is a lawyer specializing in human rights, particularly freedom of assembly and expression. He coordinates the monitoring of peaceful assemblies at the Helsinki Committee of Armenia and is a member of the ODIHR, Panel of Experts on Freedom of Assembly and Association. In 2023, Rafael, together with colleagues, he co-founded the Armenian Center for Political Rights, a watchdog organization focusing on detecting and responding to and preventing political persecution and safeguarding political rights. I'm Asbed Bedrosyan.
And I'm Hovik Manucharyan.
Please find us on social media and follow us everywhere you get your Armenian news. The links are in the show notes. We'll talk to you soon.